This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba through the hour, talking with you about what's new in healthy living, sharing some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, you can give us a call right now at 1-800-462-7413. 800-462-7413. Along with your calls through the hour, some interesting research, Zorba.
Yes, we're going to talk about what makes people happy and where does America fit within in the happiness quotient of the world.
So happiness.
Happiness. And special schools for pregnant girls, something that was extremely important for many, many years in lots of places in the country. Are they sort of going out of business? We'll talk about that.
And if they are, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Absolutely. Where's the funding coming from and what should we do?
Okay. Our recipe?
Chicken tortellini soup, heart-healthy, good comfort food, something you can serve when you're interested in having your family sort of around a nice soup meal.
And this one from Deer Park, Washington listener Patricia Nelson. That coming up soon. We have our medical myth buster, too, so don't go away. Stay with us here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Zorba to the phones, and a listener in Madison, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hey, how are you?
Fine. How can we help you?
All right. I am, number one, thrilled to be on. Appreciate you taking my call.
Oh, well, thank you.
37-year-old male who my main goal is just trying to stay healthy. That's all.
Mm-hmm.
And I eat a pretty good diet, but I still take supplements. But I get my five fruits and veggies in a day. But I'm taking flaxseed and I'm taking in the capsules and fish oil and vitamin C and a multivitamin. And I kind of have three questions to go along with this.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, is this overkill? If I'm getting my five fruits and veggies in a day, is there still a reason to be taking vitamin C and a multivitamin?
Mm-hmm.
Number two, could the acid in the C and the multivitamin interfere with the flax and the fish and maybe break it down a little bit? And then number three, is there a time in the day when I should take them? I normally take them in the morning. Right before I do my morning workout, but I've heard that you should take it right before your biggest meal of the day because then the molecules attach to the food molecules. Yeah.
A couple of general things, and I want to answer all this stuff. First of all, our bodies are smart. They're smart. They're intelligent. They do great things. They know how to digest. They know how to put things through the body. So the idea of timing of the day, what do you have to take with it? Do you take them together? The body has a way of kind of sorting things out. I have lots of faith in the body, more faith in the body than in the vitamin gurus that often proffer to know more than our body has. So time of day, irrelevant. Doesn't really make a difference. With food or without food, for most things, it's irrelevant. For drugs, it's a different issue because some drugs have to be on an empty stomach, other drugs on a full stomach. For vitamins, Now, with food or without food, interesting if you take a vitamin with iron. The only people who should take a vitamin with iron are women who are still menstruating to make up for their menstrual flow. That's it. But adults, guys, never take a vitamin with iron because in our society we're not iron deficient, and that can be a sign of other problems, especially if you're older. Now, what about the vitamins you're taking? Well, first of all, five servings of fruits and veggies, greatest serving is a handful. The data shows seven is even better. Yeah, seven is even better. Once again, it's a handful, so it's a handful of salad. So if you're having a big salad at lunch, for instance, you might be getting three or four servings. Now, what vitamins should you take? Number one, I love a multivitamin. Cheap, inexpensive. They don't cost, you know, they cost very, very little, and you can get them all over. Number two, I recommend vitamin D now for everybody. Now, why?
D as in Delta.
D as in Delta, and it should be D3. Three is in three, which is cholecalciferol. That's the scientific name. And the reason is very good data shows we're vitamin D deficient in our society in most cultures during the wintertime. But we wear sunscreen, so a lot of us are vitamin D deficient in the summertime, and the feds are debating whether or not there's too little D in a multivitamin.
And there may not be a lot of research or any at all on this, but I know there are healthcare professionals who believe that vitamin D can help with mood,
happier, cheerful person.
And
you have brought that up. So I like D 1,000 units a day, cheap, inexpensive. I price them out there, $6 for 100 tablets. So for $20, you can get your vitamin D practically for the entire day. That's multivitamin and vitamin D. Now, the data on E, worthless. That's the data. I used to like E. I was a proponent of vitamin E. Worthless. In fact, it shows that E, in some cases, such as if you're a smoker, is worse for you and may increase the risk of cancer. Flaxseed, kind of on and off. Nothing that really says for it or against it. I'm not against it. Fish oil data, pretty good. Fish is better. So at least one day a week you should have fish. But fish oil is good every day. I think that's fine. Vitamin C, the jury has been out since Linus Pauling, and it's still out. Whether or not we need vitamin C or not, the jury is out. Some studies show maybe. Some studies show maybe not. For the cold, it's worthless. It doesn't do anything. So I think C is okay. I hope it answers all your questions. But you need D. That's what you need. Vitamin D3.
Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Sure, we appreciate the call. Thank you very much for calling this number, 800-462-7413. On to Knoxville, Tennessee now. Hi.
Hi.
What's up?
Well, I have an 11-month-old daughter, and she has had a yeast diaper rash on and off pretty much when the weather is warm. Mm-hmm. And I am cloth diapering.
Mm-hmm. We hear her in the background.
Yes, right? We do. She sounds beautiful.
So I wanted to know how the Vusion ointment that the doctor has prescribed hasn't really worked well.
Mm-hmm.
And we've used it maybe every time I change her diaper up to that much a day. And I also just don't generally like resorting to prescription medicine all the time to treat everything.
Sure.
When we look at diaper rash, which is candida, which is a yeast infection, basically is a function of moisture. That's ultimately it. So, for instance, children who run around who are not diapered, who have no diapers at all, they don't get diaper rash because they're not diapered, but right, they really don't get a yeast infection. So one of the general things that we do is we protect the skin often with an ointment that tends to be semi-impervious to moisture.
Mm-hmm.
A desitin ointment, which is a zinc oxide ointment, super duper diaper do, which is another type of an ointment product. Vaseline, which the main thing the Vaseline came out for when it was invented was you could use it for diaper rash. It worked really, really well, and kids were not allergic. It wasn't like lanolin, which is what was used before with sheep, which really had an allergic component to it. So, from a point of view, from a cloth diaper versus a non-cloth diaper, is the fact that you have to change the cloth more often.
Mm-hmm.
Because the moisture tends to stay closer to the skin. And that's just one of the issues. Because in the manufactured diapers that are not cloth, that are basically, they're not paper, but what they do is they wick the moisture away to the outside. And for years, what the manufacturers have done is developed essentially a shield where the moisture goes to the outside of the diaper and the inside of the diaper tends to be relatively dry. Dry from, it's gorgeous baby. She wants to chime in on this.
Yes.
Because it's her diaper.
That's right.
So more frequent changing, and when you don't have to have a diaper, if she's, you know, with you in the kitchen or something and you're not concerned, she just urinated, for instance, keep the diaper off when she's
okay.
Outside. The whole issue is get the moisture away from the skin. So that you can actually, so the skin can actually air dry. So,
mm-hmm.
Good luck. This is your what child? How many
first.
Children? Your first child.
Uh-huh. Well,
she sounds like a wonderful little girl.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Say hi for us.
Okay, thank you. Have a great day.
Sure, thanks a lot. Appreciate the call at 800-462-7413. Okay, Zorba, make us happy. Talk about this research.
Right. Well, first of all, you know, there were a few articles in the newspaper recently about the happiness quotient in Bhutan. I don't know if you picked up on that, but Bhutan is in northern India, and they have a happiness index, and they have a minister of happiness, and it makes the news because Americans are not always considered the happiest people in the world, and a number of studies have shown that Americans are not as happy as they should be, and this was a particular study from the Gallup poll, and they asked people to rank from 1 to 10. You're on 10 ladders on a pole, and, you know, the 10th is the most happy and the most satisfied. You know, the first rung on the ladder is the worst rung to be on.
And they surveyed 100,000 people, so...
A lot of people, yeah. And it's the Gallup poll, it's good. And what they found out was that about 47% of the people in America said they're struggling. 4% are suffering, meaning they're in the bottom rank. But roughly half the people say say they're struggling and the other half say they're okay. Well, then you look and you compare it to other places like Denmark. In Denmark, most of the people are happy and doing just fine. Mm-hmm. But of course, Denmark is a country of, lo and behold, 5 million people, and America is a country of 300 million people. So,
you're saying that it's harder to be happy in a country with a lot of people?
No, it's that 300 people, you're getting a lot of different societies. Denmark is a relatively homogeneous upper-middle-class society. And if you took out upper-middle-class suburbs around America, which are similar to Denmark, they don't speak Danish, but you would find the same thing. And lo and behold, you find people with more education, making more money, you know, higher up on that social economic ladder, are happier. But there's some very interesting points here. If you go through the slums of Rio, and I've had some experience, my son Zach started an NGO in Rio and works with literacy, and I always pay attention to the Rio data. And you look at people in indigent areas, they're not all unhappy. They're not all unhappy. Part of the happiness issue is, what do you expect out of life? What are your friends and family like? And how do you see yourself within your society? Mm-hmm. And the problems that we have with America is that we all, when I say we all, I said the general feeling from advertising is you want to be on that higher socioeconomic rung. You expect to be up there.
So we're fed through the media, you're saying, images of what we ought to be or could be, and we don't feel that we meet those standards.
Right. And the issue that I take or that I think about are issues that affected me when I was a child. When I was a child, until I was 15 or 16, we only had one car. The car was always a used car. We happened to be in a neighborhood where everyone had new cars once a year. We had a used car. Mm-hmm. Our house was the smallest house probably in our neighborhood. It was a small little bi-level. The vacations that we used to go to we'd go on a car trip up to the Wisconsin Dells once every 2 years. We never took any trips. Both my parents had to work. We never considered ourselves to be unhappy. We had an old TV set. Other people had new TV sets. Mm-hmm. And the reason was my parents thought, well, this is fine. It was really interesting. And I look back at it. When I showed my kids our house, my kids looked at the house and they said, well, this is kind of small, Dad. How'd you grow up in that house? And I always think back to that, realizing that we were happy because we were satisfied with what they had. The satisfaction part of happiness is not addressed in the Gallup poll. It's, ain't it awful? The economy is suffering. I can't get that flat screen TV kind of attitude.
Yeah. Well, now here's something else, though. In the story about this study, they mention health.
Right.
And they mention that while we spend more money in the United States on health care, our health care system ranks 37th worldwide.
Absolutely. It's an abomination.
And apparently they feel that there is this connection between healthcare and happiness.
Well,
and
there is part of that connection. The economic part is on one side. The healthcare part is on the other side. Why do people often stay at their jobs when they want to leave? They're afraid of losing their insurance. What do people have a fear of? They're going to end up in the hospital. Look at Sicko, the movie, and all of a sudden not have enough money to pay for what they have. It's an abomination. If you look at the healthcare, it's also divided up into a class issue. Upper middle class people have great health care, and the statistics are as good as Denmark. People who fall below the middle class, the statistics are probably in number 40 or 50 throughout the world for health care. And the reason is we don't have universal access to health care, and that's because our government has never been able to do it. That's the problem.
Well, I'm happy that you're here every week.
Well, we want to improve the health care. That's what we're trying to do for the country. There we go.
800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. Here's a listener now, Zorba in Jacksonville, Florida. Hello.
Hi, Zorba and Tom.
How can we help?
I'm seeking some help from my wife. Mm-hmm. She's generally healthy, doesn't have any real health problems, but she suffers regularly from canker sores. She seems to have more of them than an average person would expect, and when she gets one, they're very large, very painful, and they last a long time.
Canker sores, they're awful. People hate them. I did a study a number of years ago, a research study in our office on canker sores. And when we do a study of new medications, we put a notice in the newspaper. And I had more calls for canker sores than any other study I've ever done. We put a little teeny sort of notice in the newspaper. And the first morning, we had 47 calls on the answering machine for canker sores. And I thought, oh, my goodness, it's like everybody's got canker sores. And the reason is they hurt, they're painful, and there's no great remedy. If you Google canker sores, you will get pages and pages and pages of remedies for canker sores.
You mean you did this study and got all these people, and you didn't get any results out of the study? The stuff we tried didn't work.
Didn't work. It was a lozenge, and not lozenger, because I know how to say that. It was a lozenge that had a small amount of steroid in it, and it was to try, when you had a canker sore, you'd put it in your mouth, and you'd sort of suck on the lozenge, and at the end, the placebo did just as well as the drug itself.
Let me ask the caller, what have you done, or what has your wife done for these canker sores?
Well, there's really nothing we've come up with in the way of making them go away faster. I guess I have a couple of questions. One, my wife tends to think that they are frequently induced by stress. Is that a possibility?
Well, there are a few things. They're stress induced. There's no doubt about it. People who have it, although it's stressful when you have it, and sometimes I think people are always thinking back to the last stressful moment when they have something like a canker sore, because every day most of us have stressors, and if we get a canker sore today, we'll say, must have been the boss at work and just upset me, and that's why I've got this canker sore.
But you say they really are stress
induced. It's food related. We know that people who have more yogurt, who eat lactobacillus containing products, either a capsule that has lactobacillus or yogurt with live culture, seem to have fewer canker sores. That's an old-fashioned folk remedy that really does work. We know that helps. For some people, if they eat acidic foods like orange juice, grapefruit juice, that'll bring on a canker sore, and they find individual differences. And interestingly enough, vitamin C tablets that you sort of suck on in your mouth seem to reduce the incidence of canker sores, even though vitamin C products such as orange juice seem to worsen canker sores. But they tend to come and go. And by the way, pharmacological ways are, there's something called Kenalog and Orabase, which is a little sticky steroid that you can put on canker sores. And then there are a number of over-the-counter remedies, from Camphophonique, which my mother used on her canker sores, and yucky-tasting stuff I used on my canker sores, to new toothpaste that are out there that are anti-canker sores. Anytime you find there are 20 to 30 remedies, that means nothing works consistently. Yeah. For an acute appendicitis, we know one thing works: surgery.
Right.
You know, and if you're not around a surgeon, major antibiotics. But when you get canker sores, a whole bunch of remedies, because nothing works all the time.
Well, I'll steer towards the yogurt for breakfast.
You bet. And it's got to say live culture. If it doesn't say live culture, and generally the cheap, inexpensive house yogurts that you find in most grocery stores do not have live culture. I mean, but name brands, Yoplait, Danone, and so on, they do have it.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Sure. Appreciate the call. Thank you so much for calling. Zorba, let's go to the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox now and see if we can help out a listener named Denise. Denise has a 7-year-old daughter who's having trouble with wetting the bed. Denise has tried limiting evening fluids and makes sure her daughter goes to the bathroom right before bed, but she's still having trouble staying dry. Her pediatrician recommended some bed wetting devices, but she'd like to hear your insights before she spends her money.
Right. It's an issue. It's an issue because a fair percentage of kids are still bedwetting until they become teenagers. And, you know, we say, well, our kids sleep so deeply that they don't wake up, and that's why they bedwet. In fact, you know, there's a lot of evidence that it's an issue with multiple sort of tentacles. Drug treatment is imipramine. It's an old-fashioned treatment. It's an antidepressant in small doses. 10 milligrams a day can help. I don't recommend it for kids every day, but I do recommend it for kids so they know if it works, they can go to a sleepover party and they're not going to wet. Mm-hmm. And that's the big issue. So I recommend kids have a stash of imipramine. They try it and make sure it works. There's another pill, which is a pill and in a drop form in the nose, called DDAVP, and it stops the urine from being produced at nighttime. Also, very successful with many kids. Some kids take it every night. Some kids only take it when they need it. And then there are the alarms. And the alarms are a very old-fashioned system. And the idea is that you put the alarm right underneath the bed or the bed clothing, and as soon as it gets wet, it causes the connection to occur and it wakes the child up. And
that doesn't sound like a good thing.
Well, may not be good because, you know, it's waking the child up, but some people say the alarms work. They're very expensive. But the other issues are there's guilt involved. Kids, you know, don't want to wet their bed, and so I'm really not pro-alarm. I'm much more pro you use rubber sheets – your child will grow out of it. You want to make sure there's no guilt involved. You kind of live with it with that, and you give your child that social support that I think is so important. But you try these pills so that your child can go to sleepover parties, and that's
a
big issue.
And it seems to me, I'm not a doctor, it seems to me you underline what you said, they grow out of it.
Right. Adults do not wet their bed. Very few. Very, very, very few. It's a rare event.
So keep those emails coming. Just send your questions, comments, and lifestyle tips in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Do we have a delicious listener recipe coming up for you? Chicken tortellini soup.
Delicious.
Lots more of your calls, some more research, our medical myth buster, all right where you are here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. You have a question for Zorba? Well, then give us a call. 1-800-462-7413. You'll find a line open for you right now. But Zorba, before we get back to the phones, it is, of course, recipe time. So let's welcome our listener who sent us this recipe, and we're happy she did. Deer Park, Washington listener, Patricia Nelson. Patricia, hi.
Hi.
How you doing?
I'm doing great.
How'd you come up with this chicken tortellini soup recipe?
Well, I stole it from my boyfriend.
Now, what's your boyfriend's name?
Mark.
Why don't you call this Mark's Chicken Tortellini Soup, then?
Yes, I'm going to have to.
Yeah, okay, we're going to amend it.
Mark's Chicken Tortellini Soup.
And how did your boyfriend come up with this recipe?
Well, I think his he stole it from his daughter.
Now, what's his daughter's name?
Dee Dee.
This should be Dee Dee's Chicken Tortellini Soup.
Yes.
That's interesting. Zorba, you have a daughter.
That's right, named Dee Dee.
Exactly.
But I don't think my daughter is his daughter.
No, I'm sure not, and she probably doesn't do chicken tortellini soup.
No, either. No, I don't think so. But she might get it. Now, where did Dee Dee get the soup from?
Well, we ask her, and she doesn't know.
or she won't tell.
Yeah. She just had it there.
Don't ask, don't tell. That's
now,
what we say.
The main factor of this recipe is that it's very quick and easy, right?
Right.
Okay.
Right. And you know what I like some things that are hard and difficult and take a while for presentation, but I also love quick and easy things where I can put something on the table and I can have a family meal. That's what I like. The concept of sitting down with somebody else having a meal. Big issue also in our society now, because you save money by eating at home, and that's not a minor thing. Half the dollar in America on food today is spent in restaurants. You look back 20 years ago, it was only one quarter of the money we spent in restaurants, and three quarters we spent it. Okay.
So we're going to go through these, and if you want to jump in any time, Patricia, feel free, and maybe Zorba will have a question or two for you as we go along,
okay,
too.
You bet. So start out with 6 cups of chicken broth. You use the canned chicken broth?
Yes, he doesn't. There is something he does. If he's cooking the chicken, he'll use the broth from that for 2 cups of it.
Which is absolutely great, and it tastes better. You know, you take a chicken, plop it in the water, which I sometimes do, and it will make a broth. But the canned broth
is
easy.
When you said you use the can, I was gonna say, what else is there besides the can? Of course, there's this chicken broth from the chicken. You don't have to put it in a can.
That's right. For Tom, who is a non-cooker, he wondered where chicken broth came from. Comes from the can.
All right, let's move along here.
1 cup sliced carrots, and carrots, by the way, come from the ground.
All right, enough.
They don't just come from the can.
A cup of sliced carrots.
That's right. 1/2 cup of chopped onion.
1/2 cup of chopped onions.
1/2 cup of sliced celery.
1/2 cup of sliced celery.
1/4 teaspoon of thyme. I take it you're talking about dried thyme, right?
Yes.
That's right. 1/4 teaspoon of thyme. I like the taste of
thyme. Little tea thyme.
1/4 teaspoon pepper.
quarter little tea pepper.
A bay leaf.
One bay leaf.
Now here's the biggie, Tom. 2 cups cooked chicken.
2 cups of cooked
That's right.
chicken.
And I assume you can do that by cooking chicken.
Right.
If want boneless skinless chicken breast, you can put that in water and boil it. That's a very simple, easy way. We always have boneless skinless chicken breasts in our freezer. I think of them sort of as a commodity. They're little discs. Well, they're not exactly a disc.
Patricia, do you use the chicken breasts or do you use the whole chicken?
Well, either the chicken breasts, yes, or if you have leftover chicken from another chicken.
Yeah, that's what you use. But
you can use that.
But the thing about it's very, very good for leftover chicken, like you say. It's kind of a great way to utilize leftover chicken, to use leftovers. Mm-hmm. And the boneless, skinless stuff, as I said, you throw it in the water and it's cooked before you know it. Mm-hmm. A cup of cheese-filled tortellini dried uncooked. In other words, tortellini that you buy in the store. Tom, you know where to buy tortellini, right in the store.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. You go to the store and that's where it is.
Yeah. Right. Now, I have a question. Where you live, do you have also fresh tortellini sometimes in the case, either frozen or fresh in the dairy case or in the freezer case?
I think they are, but it would be more expensive. I'm not sure.
No, but you actually hit a good point. They are 4 times more expensive. I priced them out of my store the other day.
Okay.
They're 4 times more expensive. And for some of them, I've tried to see if I can tell the difference. I don't think in a soup I would be able to tell much of a difference. I think if I were going to put a little olive oil, drizzle some olive oil and sort of pan fry them, if you will saute them, I really think that the fresh would make a difference. For soup, I would use the dried stuff. Cheaper, mm-hmm. I like that. Mm-hmm. And 2 tablespoonfuls of, I take it you use fresh parsley, not dried stuff. Is that right?
Well, either way.
Either way. Notice that note of embarrassment.
I think it's either way. I'm speaking for Mark now.
Mark. No. Mark, who is from Didi. You're speaking from Didi.
He's the father of Didi.
But the reality is I have dried parsley. I try to use fresh when I have it. But the problem with fresh is I have to have it in the house.
Both you and I, Zorba, are parsley fans.
Yeah, I happen to like parsley.
Yeah, I do
happen
too.
To like it.
Yeah.
So let's make the soup.
Okie doke.
In a large soup pot, bring the broth to a boil, add carrots, onion, celery, thyme, black pepper, and a bay leaf. Reduce the heat, simmer for 15 minutes to give the taste a chance to meld together. Mm-hmm. Add the chicken, pasta, parsley, cook, and cover for an additional 15 minutes until the pasta is done. Look at the package. The package says 8 minutes. That's all you have to do. And then you're finished. Bon appetit. Yeah. If you've got fresh parsley around, I would put fresh parsley on the top. Because it's really good. And I think this is a dynamite, simple comfort food recipe.
And Patricia, you serve this with what, a little bread on the side?
Yes, I think when we made it, I like garlic bread, so.
And this is good for us, sir?
Oh, it's good for us. If we look at the nutritional analysis, it's 230 calories, not much coming from fat. The fat, of course, is coming from the chicken. If we look at the protein, in a typical, if we take the protein of one serving of soup, it's 46% of the protein we need for the day, nearly half the protein we need from the day for 231 calories. That's, if we look at the calorie to protein ratio, that's dynamite. You know, very, very few calories will give you this much protein. It's a great recipe. I love it.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, thanks so much, Patricia, for sending this to us and being on the phone with us here. We appreciate it.
Yes, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Bye.
For sending us this winning recipe, Patricia gets a free copy of our cookbook, Heart Healthy, Low Fat, Guilt-Free, and Tasty Recipes from the Kitchen of Zorba Pastor. And if you want to enter our recipe contest, it's easy. Just email your original low-fat recipe to us at
Zorba@WPR.org.
Now, for today's recipe, you can send a stamped, self-addressed, business-sized envelope to Zorba Pastor on Your Health, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin, 53706.
Or you can come to our website at zorbapastor.org, where you can look at our resource page, find other fine recipes, or sign up for our weekly podcast.
The toll-free number if you have a question for Zorba. 1-800-462-7413. Zorba, let's welcome a listener now in St. Louis, Missouri. Hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet. How can we help you?
Well, my wife has been struggling with Crohn's disease for a little bit over a year now, and she's taken a number of different drugs, some immunosuppressant drugs, to try to get a handle on some of the symptoms of the disease, with limited success, unfortunately. So my call today is pertaining to some possible nutritional approaches to managing the disease. So there's, as I'm sure you know, a diversity of theories about the dietary approaches to controlling it. And so my question, I guess, is aside from simply maintaining a well-balanced, healthy, and nutritious diet, do you have any specific recommendations regarding foods that seem to aggravate symptoms or those that might be more suitable for someone with this condition?
And before you do that, Zorba, tell us a little bit about Crohn's disease.
Well, Crohn's disease is an autoimmune disease where basically you have areas of the intestine, mostly the small intestine, that get swollen, and you can have a bowel obstruction from it. You can have pain and discomfort. And people, what happens is the disease has ebbs and flows. So we have people with Crohn's disease who can have a 30 or 40 year history where they do just fine, and all of a sudden the bowel obstructs. Sometimes you need surgery to remove that part of the bowel, but Crohn's disease can crop up in other parts. So you don't want to do surgery unless you have to, because basically you're not curing the problem. And it's a problem. It's part of an overall problem called inflammatory bowel disease, and you have ulcerative colitis in one part of that section, if you will, and Crohn's disease in the other.
Mm-hmm.
Treatment are anti-inflammatory drugs, steroids, other drugs, a variety of drugs that are used. Also, there are a number of things such as steroid enemas that are used, as well as sulfa-based drugs. But there's really a whole cocktail. But you're interested in the food aspects of this,
exactly.
Correct?
Are you? Is your wife doing those things Zorba just mentioned?
Well, she's taken a variety of different drugs. She has taken some steroid, corticosteroid drugs. She's received Remicade infusions.
Mm-hmm. Remicade, right. Those are called biologicals, and they also work for all type of rheumatological diseases, including other autoimmune diseases, which are often rheumatological, collagen vascular diseases, a bunch of other things. And Remicade is a very good drug for that.
Well, actually, and of course, as you know, one of the unfortunate side effects of the immunosuppressant drugs is it depresses your immune system. So she's
right.
Subject to getting colds and other infections that complicate her feeling well. So.
Exactly. There is no, if you look on websites at Crohn's disease and Crohn's disease and diet, as you say, there's a plethora of stuff that you see on the website, a whole bunch of things that people say work and people say do not work. And the problem is, or the challenge, which would really be a better way to look at it, is your wife has to find out what works for her.
Right.
So she has to find out, for instance, if avoiding certain foods help her with her Crohn's disease, and taking certain foods will help her with her Crohn's disease.
And there aren't any foods that are general?
Well, there's some things. We know, for instance, that if you have Crohn's disease and you eat a lot of fiber, that sometimes that's bad because the fiber has trouble getting through the narrowing of the intestine. So often people with Crohn's disease are put on low-fiber diets versus what we're told to eat all the time by our mothers of a high-fiber diet. On the other hand, fiber, we like fiber. We like to eat fiber in, fresh fruits and vegetables, and we like to eat whole grains with fiber. So often fiber has to be tempered down and not eat as much. But once again, it's a matter of individual food preferences and finding foods that do not upset it, and that takes time. So what happens is you may take a food out of your diet, and you're not going to find out today. It's going to be a few days, 3 to 5 days, maybe a week before you'll know if it's going to make a difference. So you can be sort of whipsawed around if you make a change and the next day you feel better or worse and you say it's because of the food I ate yesterday. It's not really yesterday. It's the food you've been eating or not eating for a week that really counts for many of these things. So I haven't given you much governance here because there isn't much. It's an individual issue and she just has to try different diets.
Right. I see.
Good luck.
Okay, well, thank you.
Good luck
very
for your
much.
Wife. Thank you for your call. It's a hard, it's a very hard disease, and it's good. You have to have support, and it sounds like you're very supportive.
Best of luck from both of us. Zorba, here's an interesting question from Carolina in El Paso, Texas, who sent an email to the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox. She writes, I have a question that's really bothering me. Whenever I eat cough drops, my appetite completely disappears. Sometimes I eat them because they taste good, even though I'm not ill, and I just don't get hungry. What does this mean?
It means that cough drops have calories. Cough drops are candy. Now, if you have a cough drop with dextromethorphan, or DM, as some cough drops have, you may be having the side effects from the drug. DM can disturb the stomach, make it upset. So if it's a DM cough drop, and it'll say right on there, DM or dextromethorphan, then that's the drug, and I would stay away from that cough drop. But if not, basically, you're eating candy, and it's reducing your appetite. Well, that's what candy does. Eat candy before your meal or dessert before your meal. That's what my mom said. You may not finish your fruits and veggies.
Is this a new diet fad, maybe?
The candy diet. Do you remember years ago there was a dietary, there was candy that you ate before your meals?
No, I don't.
And the candy was called AIDS, A-Y-D-S. That candy was extremely popular in Chicago. You would have one or two pieces before your meal to curb your appetite. And the company went out of business when AIDS, A-I-D-S, came in as a disease. But when I was a kid, AIDS candies were great. They had a great name
brand.
But they
said they wouldn't have people lose weight because you're eating calories.
Well, it was a concept of eating fewer calories. I'm just telling you, AIDS candy, AYDS, were
pretty
very popular. And their brand name went south, when AIDS came in.
Well, you know, no question is too wacky for this group at Zorba Pastor and Your Health, so keep them coming. Send your emails to
Zorba@WPR.org.
You know what? We have more calls coming up. We have some interesting research in just a moment, and we have our medical myth buster. Plenty of good reasons to stay with us here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Again, our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. But before we get back to the phone, Zorba, some info on schools for pregnant girls. There's a school in Idaho which is having difficulty finding funding, and I guess that's kind of happening throughout the country.
Well, there were some major changes that went on. When I was a medical student, there was a school for pregnant girls and it was connected to a hospital, the Salvation Army Booth School for Unwed Mothers. That was the title in Chicago. And it was really a magnet school. A lot of pregnant girls came from Indiana, from Iowa, from Wisconsin, because in those days, in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, when girls got pregnant, and as soon as they started to show, they often left, quote, and visited grandma and friends because pregnancy was considered to be
a huge shame element.
Huge shame. And that changed. Society changed. Yeah. Mores changed and basically disbanded. In Chicago, that school disbanded. New York got rid of their pregnancy schools. And now there's a problem in Boise, Idaho. And in New York, they studied the schools and found out that the girls went to schools that really had some inferior services. They weren't given the same economic advantage in that. But the other side of it is that when you're pregnant, you still have issues with other kids in the school, and there may be bullying issues, and it's a problem.
Yeah. You worry a little bit about these special schools as to whether you're getting a good education while you're in the
school. Right. And, you know, we don't worry about magnet schools where it's hard to get into something where you're going to get a good education because it's competitive, right?
Right.
So we don't worry about specialty schools where it's competitive. We worry about specialty schools based on a disability, a pregnancy, something that, over which has nothing to do with intellectual accomplishments.
And one of the problems, I think, is with overall school district funding, that these kinds of schools tend to be the ones that get pinched first.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right, because it's an easy target to look at. On the other hand, when you have issues that have to do with Title IX, that have to do with funding from schools, if it's an overall public school system, those issues kind of get mainstreamed in the rest of the school. I think the issue with these schools are whether or not there's a place for individual schools within these large school systems so that a girl who is pregnant, a young woman who is pregnant, has a choice. Maybe maybe there's a choice issue, and maybe it's an issue of getting school districts together and finding ways to treat it creatively.
Trying to put myself in the mindset of, would I want to be in a school like this if I were in that situation?
Well,
I think it must vary from person to
person. Well, I remember there was a medical student, as I said, in this school where there were young teenage mothers, and it looked to me almost like they were sitting down, they had dinner together, they had lunch together. It was sort of a community food. Well, if you want that, that's okay. If it's like a dorm life, that's okay. But maybe you don't want it. And I think for young women who are pregnant and delivering a baby, it may be the choice that's important, not the school.
800-462-7413, again, our toll-free number. And Zorba, a listener with us now in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hi.
What's up?
I have to tell Dr. Zorba that I love his program. I love listening to him, and I've learned so much.
Well, you just told him that.
Thank you. Thank
and
you.
And you totally
Thank
ignored you. The co-host who is...
It's the Tom Clark Show with Zorba
that.
Pastor.
I love listening Part to both of you.
Okay. Anyway, how can Zorba help you? Since obviously I can't help you at all.
Well, I still love listening to you, Tom.
Oh, thank you.
My first question is on dementia. My grandmother had it in her early 70s, started, and she died at like 77. And then my mom started having dementia in her early 70s. I heard on your show before that you were talking about B12 as a supplement. To avoid, to help in that.
Mm-hmm.
Is that
well,
right?
there are a couple things I'd recommend. Let me talk about your mom and your grandma. How much alcohol did they drink? A lot, a little?
A little, not a lot. Mm-hmm. I mean, occasionally.
Smoking? What was their smoking?
Neither smoked.
Okay, neither smoked. Important issues. We know alcohol can cause dementia as you get older. We know smoking is a risk factor for dementia as you get older. Half of all dementia is not Alzheimer's. In older people, it's called multi-infarct dementia from small strokes. So that part we control with alcohol, one drink or less a day, aspirin every day, keeping your blood pressure under perfect control. If you have high blood pressure, making sure the pressure is not too high. Those are things that we do. Cholesterol, if you have a cholesterol problem, having it checked, getting it checked on a regular basis, and making sure your cholesterol is under control. That's one aspect. That's the cardiovascular part. Now, the Alzheimer's part, from which we don't know what causes it, there's some good evidence now. We've got some ideas, but we don't know. Keeping your mind active, very important. But the best way I explain that is, if you want to print on a Windows-based PC computer, it's Control-P, or you can go up to the file and pull down file and hit print, or you can hit the print icon. There are three or four or five different ways you can print. Well, when you've got a brain that is active, there are three or four or five ways for you to solve a problem. So if one little synapse is gone, you can't figure it out, you can go around the other way and figure it out.
Right.
And so the activity of the brain, the Nunn study, which showed that nuns who kept mentally active were less likely to show signs of dementia, even if they had Alzheimer's disease. It's very, very important.
Oh.
Aspirin a day, as I said, from the vascular side might also reduce Alzheimer's. The best study that I know of that may produce another drug is the Rotterdam dementia study. No one had dementia at the beginning of the study. It's now in its 15th year. They found people who take anti-inflammatory drugs every day for arthritis, for instance, have less Alzheimer's disease.
Mm-hmm.
Study is very important study. So I take a naproxen every day. I take two over-the-counter Aleve tablets, generic, not the name brand.
Right.
Naproxen tablets. I take it every single day because the Rotterdam study shows anti-inflammatory drugs may be an issue. There are a number of drug companies that are trying to show their drug works well. Celebrex, made by Pfizer, has a long-term study going on. But frankly, Aleve is cheap. It's inexpensive. Now, vitamins, I recommend a multivitamin with B12 and folate. Regular old-fashioned multivitamin, because there's some evidence that B12 deficiency and folate deficiency may also be a factor. That's what I do. I worry about that. I mean, I worry about, I'm not a worrier, but I'm concerned about my health in other ways. Mm-hmm. But I don't want what my mom had with Alzheimer's disease. And so
and
that's what I do.
I take a prenatal vitamin, which is prescribed by my doctor. I have to get at the pharmacy. And I didn't know if I should take an extra B12 supplement.
Oh, no.
Supplement.
No, they have enough. There's enough B12 in every prenatal and every multivitamin. You do not need to supplement more B12. Some people say you may need a milligram of folate for Alzheimer's, but I don't see anything.
I was just going to say, everybody knows this, I guess. There is a hereditary aspect to it.
There is. Yeah, well, I don't know if everyone knows it. So you bring up a good point. There is a hereditary component, but we don't know if that's a different form of Alzheimer's. We know that in early onset Alzheimer's, how young was your grandma?
She was around 68 to 70.
Yeah, so that's earlier because we know the risk is really high in the 80s. Good luck to you, and thank you so much.
Yep. Appreciate it.
We appreciate your call. Thank you. 800-462-7413. Zorba, let's take a couple of minutes here for our medical myth buster. We have a listener myth today from Jim in St. Louis, Missouri, who sounds like a concerned singer. Jim writes, "Recently, I heard an interview with a young soprano who'd been told that caffeine, quoting, dries out the vocal cords, which naturally caused her to eschew coffee and tea. Does this make sense to you?"
Well, this is an old myth. The old myth is that caffeine is a potent diuretic. And the answer in the best data that I could find is that is a myth. It is not a potent diuretic. Now, we do know when you drink caffeinated products that when the caffeine goes into the bladder, it irritates the bladder and causes people to want to urinate. In other words, it can be a bladder irritant. But a diuretic, does it actually remove more water than it puts in? In other words, a cup of coffee, do you then get a cup and a half of urine? I don't think there's any data. And the best study that came out was a mega study of 10 studies where they took consumption of caffeinated beverages to see whether or not they urinated all that came in. In other words, you got a cup that went in. How much did you urinate? They followed them for 24 hours. A cup in produced a cup out.
Okay.
A mug in produced a mug out. A liter of coffee in produces a liter of coffee out. Yes, you feel like you have to go to the washroom, but no, you don't urinate more than the coffee you consume.
And it doesn't dry out the vocal cords.
It does not dry out the vocal cords, not at all. But hydration of any sort is really good for the vocal cords.
Interested in having Zorba bust your myth? Send it along in an email to us at
Zorba@WPR.org.
Our toll-free number is 800-462-7413. And Zorba, our next listener, is with us in Sweetwater, Tennessee. Hi.
Hi there.
What's up?
Well, I have a question, and it sounds like a joke, but it's really not. But when you're in the middle of a sneeze, why is it almost nearly impossible to open your eyes? Which, I mean, is important if you're in the middle of driving somewhere.
I know. Oh, I noticed that. And I still remember my father used to sneeze all the time during allergy season. No good allergy medicines when I was a kid. And he used to close his eyes. And my mother, who was always a frightened, shy woman, would go, Arch, we're going to die.
I was in a car
she
once.
She thought he was going to wake him up.
I was a passenger in a car once when the driver sneezed and ran into a tree.
Exactly.
And we got a ticket and went up to the courthouse and I was with the driver and the judge let the driver off. Said, we'll call this an act of God.
An act of God, the tree moved in the middle of the road. You were in, how old were you in this car?
Well, I was an adult in the car.
You were an adult in the car.
Yeah.
He sneezed and drove into a tree?
Yeah.
Did he have anything to drink before he sneezed?
No, it's just you can lose control because, as our caller says, you can close your eyes and the sneeze just caused the... we weren't going 100 miles an hour. This was in town, and it just took a little bit off the road and into a tree.
Yeah, so did you ever go with that driver again in the car?
Yeah. Never happened again.
It's part of the reflex. That's just what that's the best I can explain it. It's part of the reflex. The issue is, why do we close our eyes? Like, what is the evolutionary reason that we close our eyes when we sneeze? And, of course, for that, you'll have to write Charles Darwin, and he's on a different show, which is no longer prominent out there. But I have no idea why that is. It's part of the reflex. Yeah. And the problem, one of the problems, there's another reflex, which is when you go from a dark to a suddenly dark situation to a light situation, it often produces a sneeze. It's the light sneeze reflex, and it's got a name to it that I can't remember right now. So, for instance, a lot of people, when they come out of a dark parking lot and all of a sudden they're in a bright light, will sneeze. And that's the moment that they cross over the penumbra, which is the shadow of that. They'll go into the bright light, and all of a sudden they sneeze. And often that's when they're just out of the parking lot, and there's cars around, and they have to turn right or left, and their eyes are closed. So I have a feeling that we have a number of people out there who have gotten into accidents when they sneeze, and I bet you they'll write us emails to Zorba@WPR.org, and we'll let Adam answer those emails.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Before we get out of here, Zorba, let's check in on the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox and help out Rick in Wittenberg, Wisconsin. Rick writes, I'm one of several guys aged late 50s to mid-60s who work in a distribution warehouse where we each walk several miles a day on a concrete floor. One of the guys heard a waitress on your program who started wearing special pantyhose. He bought some women's pantyhose on the web and says it's good and we should all try it. But another coworker found a website that says these pantyhose shouldn't be worn without a doctor's prescription. Money is short for all of us, and we don't have health insurance. Can anyone wear this stuff safely without seeing a doctor?
Yes. Any male who wants to wear pantyhose can do it without seeing a doctor. Yeah. I have now given blanket permission for all the men in the United States of America to wear pantyhose without doctor's
permission.
Or any
other women's undergarments.
whatever you feel works for you, you can definitely wear. But you know, you could call them leotards, and all of a sudden we're in another realm.
Yeah.
And we can call them support stockings, which are much more expensive, and we're within another realm. But I think the pantyhose are working from putting some pressure on the veins within the legs, and that actually probably reduces swelling and reduces the pain and discomfort. But I want to know what he says when he checks out at the drugstore or the department store.
He ordered it on the web.
Oh, on the web.
On the web, I see.
So it's not the same thing. But yes, pantyhose are just fine. He's got my permission.
If you'd like to talk ladies' clothes with Zorba or just have a health or lifestyle question, send us an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Zorba, we'll see you next time.
Take care, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our recipe podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org.
Don't forget, you can bug our producer anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's produced by Adam Friedrich. Brad Kohlberg is the guy flipping all the switches. Charles Monroe Kane is our executive producer. Gigi Holland fills your recipe requests. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll be with us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0517Z. More on healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, show archives, and listener feedback, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.